We're doing the laws of Mukta. We're doing the laws of Mukta. We had described last week that Mukta has basically three starting points in Jewish history. We know there's a starting point before Shlomo HaMelech, that when David HaMelech passed away, Shlomo couldn't move the body. We know that Mukta has a starting point in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah when they saw people doing business on Shabbos and having their vats open on Shabbos. So they prohibited touching any tools on Shabbos, even your fork and knife. And then as time went on, they reduced the stringency of the prohibition. And we know the story of Mukta, the dried figs, that when a person puts it out of his usage and it becomes non-usable, becomes really, you take the figs, you put them up to dry, and now they're non-edible. So when you have those two components together, so then you have the classical, what we might call mukta, which is now not permissible to use. We described that mukta, that we're most familiar with, is klishim lachto li'isu, an instrument that's used for prohibited action on Shabbos, like a hammer, like a pen. Things that what you do with them is prohibited on Shabbos. Klishim nachtol li'isur, we described, has the leniency that if you need to move it because you need the space, you left the pen on your bed, you want to go lie down, there's a pen there. You come down for your Shabbos meal and you forgot the hammer there, you're fixing something just before Shabbos. So those items that are klishim nachtol li'isur were permitted to move them, litzorech mikomo, because I need their space, and also litzorech gufo. If I need the hammer to open up a coconut, I can use that hammer. So that was the mukta of klishim nachto liyisur. Then we described mukta mechamat gufo, that there are things that are not an instrument. You have things that are really not usable. They're not food. They're not there for as an instrument. And you can't really use them on Shabbos. So though they are a more stringent form of mukta. For example, a rock. Yeah, a rock isn't a tool. So you can't come to a kiddush and say, I'm going to put a rock on my napkins. They don't fly away. The rock is mukta. But you'll say, I need that rock. Well, if you needed the hammer, you could argue that you could move the hammer. Because a hammer is an instrument. It's a kli, shem nachto li'isur. It's an instrument used for prohibited action. But when you have something that's not a kli, it's not an instrument, so then that, even if you need its weight, or you need its space, you're not allowed to move it directly. We're still going to discuss how I might be able to move, but I'm not allowed to move it directly. And as such, mukta mechamat gufo includes many things, such as money. Money is not an instrument. And then we went on to discuss basis le davar asur, that sometimes you have an item that's playing a supportive role for something which is prohibited. For example, you have your laptop bag. So that bag is meant for the laptop. The bag is supporting the laptop. We said in order for something to be a basis de devar asur, we need to fulfill a few details. Number one, it has to play a supportive role, just like the bag is supporting the laptop. It can't just, you put a laptop on the table, so even though the laptop is sitting on the table has many other purposes. It's not there for the laptop. Number two, there has to be intent. You want your laptop in the laptop bag. But if you have a drawer that has many things all around it, if you have a suitcase that has your clothing and your laptop and a million other things in it, so then it's not there just to support the laptop. So you need to want the item specifically there. It has to play a supportive role. It has to be supportive for the thing that's mukta. It has to be there when Shabbos enters. Then the item might become mukta itself as a basis ledavar ha'asur. I don't know if we discussed last semester the response of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he discusses importance. If I have candlesticks on a tray, so my candlesticks are made of silver, they're worth $1,000, $5,000. So when the candles are lit, so for sure everything's mukta, I can't move it. Now the candles go out. The candlesticks are still mukta, because the candlesticks are there for the candles. They're there, they're a mukta item. The tray, which the candlesticks are on, is a basis, it's playing a supportive role for the candlesticks. So I can't move that tray. But what would be if before Shabbos, I put on that tray my glasses. I put on that tray the challah which I'm using on Shabbos. Now the tray plays a supportive role for two things, for the candlesticks and for a piece of challah. The piece of challah cost a shekel, the candlesticks cost $5,000. Does it play an equal supportive role? No. It's playing a much greater supportive role for the challah. Why? Because on Shabbos, I need the challah. I'm going to eat the challah. So that's why, even though the challah monetarily is worth much less than the candlesticks, the fact that I need the challah for Shabbos makes it that it's playing a supportive role for both. So a guy asked me, he left in his laptop bag, he left some sfarim that he needed on Shabbos. He needs those sfarim on Shabbos. And now the laptop bag becomes a basis, the davar asur umutar. The laptop bag has both of them. It has his sfarim, which he needs on Shabbos, and his laptop. Rav Moshe also says another interesting leniency. He says, it's not so obvious that candlesticks are kli shem nachtoli isur, because if you leave your candlesticks, when I was growing up, so we grew up, they have this thing in America called the break front. A break front. A break front is basically shelves with a glass door, and you keep your silverware over there, and it adorns your living room. So my father comes from a Yekish family, German, and my mother comes from a Polish family. And when at one point my parents bought a break front, so that was what we grew up with. One day my mother tells me, I just want you to know how good the Yekis are. So my mother's telling me how special the German families are, not her side of the family. My mother says to me, our break front is the way Polish families have it. But if you go to a German home, if you go to a Yekish home, you'll see that all their silverware is behind wooden doors. They also keep it in a break front, but they're not. They don't let the guests see it. They're not there. Who knows who would get jealous if they saw it? So, what? Not in terms of steal it. In terms of why would you want other people to be jealous of you? So my mother said to me, you should just know you grew up with this. But if you'd ever get to go to your grandparents' house, your German grandparents' house, you'd see that all their silverware is behind wooden doors. No one sees it. It's not. But Rav Moshe, coming back to silver candlesticks, Rav Moshe said that being that there are people who leave their candlesticks out, even when they're not lit, just to adorn the table. People have candlesticks either in a break front or other things. He says they're also an item that beautifies your home. It's not just there for the candles. And that's why it's not so obvious, as Rav Moshe, to say that candlesticks are only a kli shem nachtol isur. We also had a discussion about a year or two ago about a gun. A person that carries a gun is a gun a kli shem nachtol isur. Or, do we say that the main usage of a gun is to cause, instill fear in those that might cause harm to you or the people living around you. Being that statistics are that almost every person that has a gun does not use it, meaning that most people that own guns never use them, never, literally zero, never, statistically. And I can tell you that last night I told you a few stories of the Intifada. What I didn't tell you is that almost every week I was a minute away from a terrorist attack. When the car was ramming people on Bar Ilan Street, I was two buses behind that. When a stabbing happened in the back of the Tachana Merkazit, I was in the front. When a stabbing happened up the block, I was down the block. When a car exploded by the kiosk by Binyanei HaUma, I was the next stop down. When a car rammed into Givat HaTachmoshet, I had just left Givat HaTachmoshet. When a shooter came and shot at people at the Givat HaTachmoshet stop, I was still on the bus. When a car rammed into Shar Binyamin, the gas station at Chizma, I walked off the bus as the soldiers shot the guy who was trying to mow down the people. I literally walked off and saw the gunshots. It happened so many times. It happened so many times that I'm just saying it made me realize that even if you're literally a minute away, but the odds of you being there when it happens, so you could look at it and say, thank you, Ribono Shel Olam, which is what I did every day, right? Every time I walk off the bus and I see this truck that just ran into the bus station, and I say, thank you, Ribono Shel Olam. I show up to the Givat HaTachmoshet stop. You guys know where Rav Uri Sherki's son was killed. The Arab driver ran straight into the bus stop. I stood at that bus stop every night. That night I wasn't there. I'm saying, but every night I stood at that bus stop where Avuri Sharkey's son was killed. Every night. That's my bus stop when I don't come to the Machon. So every bus stop I stood by, there was a ramming attack. I'm saying, aside from the stories I told you last night about the old city. I'm just saying, coming back to here, what's the main reason people have guns? It's not in order to shoot the terrorist, because statistically you're not going to. Meaning that statistically you might be very close many times, but the odds of you being the one to have a gun, so it assists our security. It might be a good thing for people to have guns in this country. Maybe. So it's a good question you'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi, because statistically, I'm not sure if more people get killed or saved by having guns. It's a good question. You have to find out whether there are more shooting accidents that people die from owning guns, or there are more people saved by the fact that there are people around with weapons. So that's a separate question. But I'm not a fan of people carrying around guns, because people forget their guns and they fall into the wrong hands. It's very common that people lose their weapons.
You also don't know the effect of deterrent effect.
Right, so the deterrent effect, that's what some poskim say, that the deterrent effect is the main reason you carry a gun, the deterrent effect. And in light of that, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that might be a reason to own a gun. Maybe.
I'm not even saying a lot of people carrying guns around.
I understand. I haven't noticed the deterrent effect working. I haven't noticed that.
I don't know what it could be. I don't know.
I see that they try to stab the soldier who has a gun. I see that they attack the person with the gun himself. I haven't seen that working. But let's leave that. I'm saying that. You'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi. I'm talking about Mukta. I'm talking about Shabbos. Right. So if you ask me, I think it needs to be analyzed on a per-person basis. But for most people, I think the right answer is not to own a gun. For most people. You know, it depends on every person's scenario. I think for most people, people end up forgetting it. People end up, children end up touching it. I mean, there have been too many accidents, and again, the statistics, I'm working with the statistics, they don't seem to point in the direction that it's wise for most people. There are exceptions. Depends on the person and the scenario. Can a person tell me, I can guarantee you 100% that my gun will never be outside the safe when I'm at home. I will not walk around with a loaded gun. There are many things that, depending on the person, it might be wise for that person to own a gun. But for most people, it's the danger outweighs the benefit. That's my humble opinion. You're welcome to ask someone else coming back to here. But in terms of carrying a gun on Shabbos, is a gun muktzah? Well, wait a second, you don't do anything with your gun. What you're doing with your gun is you're holding on to it as a deterrence. It depends on the person. For most people, if they're be honest with themselves, the main point of having the gun is a deterrent. So if your gun is a deterrent, you walk around and everyone sees it, and now it's a deterrent, okay, so then it's not mukta. There definitely are opinions you can rely on that say a gun isn't even mukta. Because you're not, your main usage is you're using it as a deterrent. It could be.
If you know the statistics, you can't say it's
necessary. So I should have started differently. I was dealing with mukta. But when we dealt with guns a year and a half ago, so back then I said that the first most basic thing you have to know is that in a circumstance where there might be cause for carrying a gun, so then of course you should carry a gun. I got a phone call, someone asked me from Harnof 7 years ago, or 6 years ago, should they carry their gun to shul on Shabbos? I said, yes. So they said, but we're in Arnov. Nothing happens in Arnov. I said, Baruch Hashem, so far nothing's happened in Arnov. Carry your gun to shul. And the shul he went to was Bnei Torah, where they massacred 5 people. And I told him, I said, how many people? Everyone thinks you don't have to have a gun. I said, that's why. In that shul, make sure to carry your gun on Shabbos, because if your calculation is security, so then there's no question. If there's any room to think that for security purposes you need to carry a gun, so then it doesn't matter if it's muktzeh. Carry the gun. That's not the question here. I'm saying that's not the question. We're talking about a situation where you live in Beit El, there are 50 people in shul with a gun. You walk into shul, you look around, every second person has a gun on them. So now, should I carry my gun to shul? Right? I'm going to be the Rambo here. So the question becomes, is the gun mukta? If the gun is mukta, so then I need 2 people in shul with a gun. 3 people in shul with a gun. I don't need more than that. So then why should I carry the gun? There are 50 people in shul with a gun. So then comes the question, is a gun mukta? So if the main purpose of the gun is a deterrent, so then I'm allowed to carry a gun, it's not mukta. Again, I gave all this introduction, I was just touching on it, but you're right, some of you guys weren't there last year, so But if you're living in East Jerusalem, if you're in a place where you need it for your security, okay, so then of course you'd carry your gun. There's no question about it. We also discussed Mukhtse Mechamat Chason Kis. There's a type of Mukhtse because something is used for something prohibited. But it's not only that, it's a very expensive item, or it's a unique item that you wouldn't use for anything else. You don't use it for things other than its intended purpose. So that is a more stringent form of mukta, which you would not be allowed to move the tzorach gufo mikomo. So an example of that would be if you have, the examples in halacha are a shechita knife. That's a very special knife. You spend a lot of time sharpening it. You only use it to shecht animals. So you're not allowed to slaughter an animal on Shabbos. So that knife is mukta. It's a klishim nachto leisur. No, it's more stringent than that. It's mukta mechamat chesron kis. It is mukta because it is unique in its value. You wouldn't use it for anything else. I argue that the same is true with smartphones. People would not let their smartphone be used for anything other than the usages of a smartphone because it's very expensive and you have unique uses for it. And it's the same thing. We had discussed at the time that if you use your phone as an alarm clock, so then the phone might not be mukta altogether because it has permissible usages on Shabbos. If you use your phone, you could always see the time on the phone. So there we went into the details. How much do you use it? How usable is it? Etc. We went into that. I'm just doing a brief recap of what we discussed in Mukta.
What? The recap is very helpful.
Okay. One area that comes up often is raw meat. In the days of the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch, you had people eating raw meat. Nowadays, up until recently, no one ate raw meat. So the meat in your freezer was mukta. Lately, you guys said there's a capacho, gazpacho, something like that. There's this type of meat which people are eating raw. So there's room to reopen the discussion of raw meat not being mukta again. Because in the days of the Shulchan Aruch, it wasn't mukta, being that there were people who were eating it. And then 30, 40, 50 years ago, everyone agreed pretty much that now it's mukta, because no one's touching raw meat. You guys are saying there's this new food now that people are eating raw meat. There's room to reopen the discussion. It could be that raw meat is again not going to be mukta.
You say there would be room to discuss. Would that be with regard to the type of meat that is eaten raw and not?
It's a good question. I don't know enough about it. I don't know how many people are eating it. I don't know which meat. Maybe you could do it with every meat. They just choose to do it with a specific meat. I don't know enough about it.
It's a discussion that can be had.
It should be had. I don't know enough about it. Someone has to research it, get the facts, and reach a conclusion. There's an interesting thing about pots, that a pot that you're using on Shabbos is not mukta, right? You have cholent in your pot, it's not mukta. You touch that pot on Shabbos. A pot that you have soup in, it's not mukta. What about your empty pots? So your empty pots are klishim lachto l'isur. They're an instrument that's used for prohibited action on Shabbos. They're used for cooking. When you're using the pot on Shabbos, so that's okay, that's not mukta. What happens if I want to transfer, I have only a little bit of cholent left, I don't want to put the big pot in the fridge, it'll take up half my fridge. I want to put back a small pot, so I'm going to take a small pot off the shelf, take the remaining cholent or soup, put it in the small pot, put it in the fridge. Can I do that? So that's called tzorach gufo, right? We said, klishem lachto l'isur, an instrument that's used for a prohibited action on Shabbos is mukta. But if I need it for itself, for its body, I need the pot now, so then I'm allowed to move that mukta. So I'm allowed to take the smaller pot and transfer the remainder cholent or soup into that pot, even though it's mukta. Depends on how often they use it for that. Is that a prime usage of it? And that goes into the discussion I think we also had at the end of last semester, that we don't have to stop our kids from certain things, like building with Legos. We discussed that Lego is not mukta for the adult, but an adult shouldn't build with Lego. Children are allowed to until they reach an age that's old enough to understand, like 9, 10, 11, that they shouldn't be playing with Lego on Shabbos. In terms of building a tent, that's a much younger age. They can understand. You're not supposed to build tents on Shabbos. You're not supposed to build a garage for your car with the Lego on Shabbos. That's at a much younger age. But in terms of playing with Lego, and you're allowed to move the Lego they're playing with and help them collect them, put it away. In that sense, it's not mukta to you. Yes?
Question with regards to building a tent, and I guess bone in general. If setting up a hammock, meaning where everything, where you don't have, it doesn't involve any tying, It just involves clipping. But will you be able to clip?
It's a long discussion. If we might get to it at the end of Muktzah.
Okay.
So Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked, there are people who read romance novels. So Rav Moshe says, they're not supposed to read romance novels. Why would a person read things that cause them to have inappropriate thoughts? But they don't know that, says Rav Moshe. So they read it all week long. So the man who asked Rav Moshe Feinstein the question asked him like this. He said, there are people who read romance novels. So even though they shouldn't, they do. Are we going to tell them that the romance novels are muktzah on Shabbos? Because they're not supposed to be handling them. So Rav Moshe said no. He said, you have to know, when does something become muktzah on Shabbos? When its prohibition stems from Shabbos. If the prohibition stems from something else, you're not supposed to be handling a book that's going to cause you to have inappropriate thoughts. So they're not supposed to be reading that. That doesn't make it muktzah on Shabbos. That makes it that they shouldn't be handling it all week long. But being that they don't know that, so they do read these books, so for them it's not muktzah. Ah, but you know that. So you wouldn't touch that, right? You wouldn't care. So for you it might be muktzah, because you wouldn't handle it. But for people who think it's permissible, and they read it, so for them, handling it is not muktzah. And here Rav Moshe tells us the basic concept that in order for something to be muktzah, its prohibited usage must stem from the laws of Shabbos, not from other angles. We also discussed electronic appliances. That electronic appliances are kli shem nachtoli yisur, it would seem. We left that as a point in question. We brought the machloket whether a fan is viewed as a kli shem nachtoli yisur, because in order to get it started, you do a prohibited action, you turn it on. Or do we say your usage of a fan is when it's on? You turn it on in the morning, it's running all day. You turn it. So is that a kli shem nachtoli yisur? So we brought a machloket regarding that. We discussed that Rav Moshe says that a tape recorder is a kli shem nachtoli yisur, and we said that that doesn't prove anything, because a tape recorder, you have to keep turning it on. It doesn't run for more than 45 minutes without you doing a muktzah action, switching the sides, turning it on. It's not the same as a fan that can run all day long once you turned it on. We also discussed that Rav Moshe says that moving something letzorech gufo is also when I need the fan to be pointing away from me. You would say I only need it if I need it to point at me. Rav Moshe says that's also called tzorech gufo. I'm allowed to move the fan to point away from me. We said if it's all mechanical, so then it's okay to move the switch that makes the fan turn and stay static. We also discussed the idea of radiators, that when you move them so the thermostat turns on, you cause the heat element to turn on and heat up the oil, so you shouldn't move a radiator when it's off. But once it's on, if you need it somewhere else because you need it to heat a different part of the room, then you're allowed to move it even though there is a heat element there. You need it, that's muktzah, but it's tzorech gufo. I need it here, so I'm allowed to roll it somewhere else. The same thing with a lamp. Tzorech gufo, I'm allowed to move it. And one thing I don't think we mentioned this semester was the funny story I had 2 or 3 years ago, that a guy calls me up. There was a blackout in Kochav Yaakov, and a guy calls me up and he asks me, are flashlights muktzah? I said, yeah. Am I allowed to use it if I have darkness in my house? Am I allowed to move the flashlight from place to place to see what's going on? And I said, yeah, you're allowed to move it, because that's exactly what Rav Moshe said. So I come to shul that night, there's a blackout, the whole shul is dark, we're in the middle of davening, we have a little bit of light coming in still from outside, and a guy walks in with a headlight into shul. So we're standing in shul davening, and in walks this guy. You can't see who he is, because, you know, he has this beam of light emanating from his head, but he's standing there with a headlight. So the whole shul looks at him, and we're all wondering who's this guy who walked in. And, okay, we're all nice, decent people, no one said a word. But he's getting these looks. So the next morning, his son comes by, and his son asks me, did my father do anything wrong? My father sent me to ask you, did my father do anything wrong? So I said, I don't know, why would you think your father did something wrong? He says, well, he came to shul last night with the headlight. I said, that was your father. So he says, yeah, and people looked at him. So I said, well, technically... And then the son tells me, my father is telling everyone that you said it's okay. So I said, wait, your father didn't tell me he wants to walk to shul with a headlight. Your father asked me about moving a flashlight in the house. Technically, halachically, he's right. Technically, you're allowed to move a flashlight on Shabbos, but realistically, it would be a true desecration of Shabbos if everyone would start walking around with headlights. We have blackouts once to twice a winter going into Shabbos. It's a fairly common occurrence by us. And so if people would start walking around with flashlights on Shabbos, so then it would end up that people turn on flashlights, turn off flashlights, it would end up being a desecration of Shabbos. So it's not the appropriate way to behave. There's a reason why no one else does it. You're right that technically, halachically, if there's a need, you can do it. You're allowed to move a flashlight in your house, and you would also be allowed to walk outside with a flashlight if it were exceptionally necessary. But just to come to shul on Friday night, well, if he needs the flashlight for that, and it's going to end up being that if he walks in with a flashlight, other people will walk in with a flashlight, ultimately it will cause the desecration of Shabbos, better daven at home. There's a reason that no one else is walking around with flashlights, and you shouldn't. You shouldn't walk around. I didn't understand from his question that he was going to take it that far. You know, he asked me about the house. I didn't understand he was talking about coming to shul, but he inferred correctly. Technically, by the letter of the law, what he did was kosher. We have to understand the spirit of the law, and that's why it's not kosher. That's why we shouldn't do it, because of where it would lead to. So that's a brief overview of the laws of Muktzeh. Today we finished it. Next week we start going into more details into the laws of Muktzeh. We discussed the wallet being both a basis l'davar asur, because the wallet is playing a supportive role to your money, and being Muktzeh in itself, because the purpose of a wallet is to house your money. So its usage is a prohibited usage, and that's why we said you wouldn't be allowed to move a wallet because it's a basis, and it's a basis to things that are Muktzeh mechamat gufo. Even if your kids emptied your wallet and now you wanted to move it, you couldn't move it because it's Muktzeh in its own right. So you have both aspects, the basis the davar asur, which makes it Muktzeh. The wallet is Muktzeh all of Shabbos, even if the money somehow falls out of it during Shabbos. And it's Muktzeh because its usage is Muktzeh. We also discussed a little bit the idea, if you find money in your pocket on Shabbos, the idea of pouring it out, not touching it directly, because technically you're carrying money. And we discussed the idea of different pockets, whether the pocket is its own cloth or it's a part of the garment. Okay, so that's where we left off last semester. And here we'll pick up, Ezrat Hashem, next week.